This podcast is rated S for science and also for spoilers and swearing. There's going to be swearing.
Something is killing these people and sucking them dry.
Run! It's a stampede!
In worlds seen and unseen, where spirits are transformed and sorcerers rule, one girl's future depends on her judgment.
Aren't you getting wet out there? I'll leave the door open for you.
Welcome everybody to Cinematic Animalia, the podcast where we break down the biology of movie monsters. Today, we are starting the first part of a doubleheader looking at Spirited Away in celebration of the 20th anniversary of this movie,
woo,
right?
Woo, woo, woo.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, fantastic. So it's a Studio Ghibli doubleheader. We'll go over some news first, tell you a bit about the movie and our thoughts, and then we will get stuck into some of the science that this movie brings up, primarily focusing on no face. I will have a quick look at mimicry, expanding stomachs, and how a person could potentially operate 8 limbs at once. As always, the show's broke up into a few different parts. There'll be time codes below. Skip ahead to what you're looking for. But before we get into all of that, my name is Sam Perrin. Ooh. I am back.
Survive the trolls.
He's here.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, it's like, you guys were making fun of this, but they're really not doing well. Like, I mean, they're large...
charismatic megafauna.
They're charismatic megafauna. They're really well suited for cold areas. Mm-hmm. Climate change is really doing damage to the troll population up here. They are dying out. That's particularly worrying for me, because that's a lot of, you know, my genetic ancestry, that sort of stuff. I'd appreciate no more jokes about it, okay? It's really not something that should be made light of. Yeah.
We won't troll you about it anymore.
Yeah, 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 yeah. Yep.
Oh, I see what you did there.
Water.
Anyway. alongside, I'm a freshwater / invasive ecologist up in Norway. With me is Adam Harsick, Dr. Adam Harsick.
Thank you.
A disease / parasite ecologist, currently at the University of Arkansas, but soon to be at a postdoc at the Ben Gurion University of the Negev. Alongside Adam is the Baroness, Libby Young, our story specialist and writer at Short Story Soup. And as always, we're joined by Dave, our vet and movie physiologist. Oh, we got there.
Nice.
You did it. You did forget to mention we're doing our double header of Spirited Away today, and then Princess Mononoke next week. And the week after that, we'll be having an in-depth discussion about Ghibli versus Ghibli. What are your thoughts?
Oh, is this the discussion?
Amongst a lot of people, it apparently is.
Really? Okay. Is there not some, like, hard focused way to say it from the Japanese?
I think it has something to do with the fact that Ghibli is an Italian word and is pronounced Ghibli, I think, there. But the way it's pronounced in Japan is Ghibli.
Studio Ghibli.
That's definitely.
Yeah. There's like a couple nights ago, Libby actually looked it up, and it was a pretty in depth analysis of Italian word, but the Japanese pronunciation is this. But then didn't Miyazaki himself say that for English speaking, it's Ghibli? Right? Or something like, or he didn't come down one way or the other?
Jesus.
No, it's Ghibli. You could just make it a silent G and just say Ibli.
Studio Ghibli.
Studio Ghibli.
Gente.
Ghibli.
But how is it pronounced in Libyan Arabic? Well, like this.
Ghibli.
We wanted to focus on some positive news this week because we've been on a bit of a negative trip recently. But then I woke up this morning and I saw that the World Heritage Council has agreed not to put the Great Barrier Reef on the in danger list, despite extensive recommendations from the UN's science branch. I don't know if people know about this, but there's this thing called climate change that's happening. It's been around. I feel like it's part of our vernacular these days. And it's really, really badly damaging the Great Barrier Reef in Australia, which, you know, means a lot to people worldwide, means a lot to me. It's, you know, one of my favorite memories from my childhood, now one of my son's favorite memories from his childhood as well. And because of these extreme heat waves we're seeing, it undergoes massive amounts of bleaching every year. Bleaching is essentially when coral will expel the organisms that it lives in symbiosis with, plants, algae. Which give it life and give it color. And that's when the entire reef turns white. There's a lot of different things that play into this. Ocean acidification plays a part as well, but a lot of it is just climate change. And so because of heat waves we've seen over the last 4 or 5 years, entire chunks of the reef have been wiped out. Some of it's coming back, but because climate change is kind of a thing that's just ongoing.
And getting worse.
And getting worse, it does mean that we're probably looking at the widespread death of the reef over the next 2 decades. And this is pretty solid science. Like, there's not really much debate about this amongst most reef or climate or even just marine ecologists. But Australia kind of positioned this move as political lobbying by China. To stop Chinese tourists going to Australia. And that's how Australia were able to go around the world convincing all these different people who are part of, you know, the World Heritage List that it didn't deserve a place on the in danger list, which makes me fucking furious.
So stupid.
It's just really sad to see, like, something just unnecessarily political cost much, you know,
something we can relate to all too well here in the US right now.
I will say, Sam, there's I don't know if you've ever seen this, but there's a really good documentary called Spawning Hope, and basically there's a bunch of researchers that capture coral, I don't know the right word for it, and then they transport them and regrow them from babies, and they're trying to rebuild reefs.
It's really cool.
Yeah, okay. So I spoke to Dr. Sean Connolly about this a couple of years ago. Sean is a marine biologist from James Cook University in Townsville. Okay. He said that is a really promising way forward. The problem is at the moment, it only really works on small scale. Okay. And what he's afraid they're going to use that to do is plant that in the areas where tourists already are.
Yeah.
Right? So that tourists can come along, see that everything's fine. Mm. And just go back and be like, yep, reef's fine. No worries. I don't need to change my behaviors at all. I actually had that experience kind of 2-3 years ago when I went to the Great Barrier Reef. One of the tour guides was just like, you don't need to worry about any of this bleaching stuff. We're going to plant new super coral. Everything's fine. And
literally isn't.
Wow.
Nope. Literally isn't.
We have a saying for that here in the South called lipstick on a pig.
Man, you guys think Joe's as happy as he says he is just doing all that desk work?
No way. He's just putting lipstick on a pig.
This is called Crimson Sky. What do you think?
Mmm.
Harold?
Get this off of me!
On positive news, so that we're not always dark and terrible and everything is awful, France has just put a new policy in place as of 2020. So I don't know if you guys know what happens to male chicks when you get eggs. But both
they do all too well,
right?
Fortunately.
So horrible process, but basically once they're born and they're sexed and they're found to be males, they're put into usually a grinder or a machine where they're basically just jumped in and then crushed, or they're physically crushed by hand, or they're gassed. Now, France has put a new policy in place that as of 2020, this policy must be stopped. And they'll be pushing for farmers to basically get new equipment that will be supported by grants from the government that will allow them to detect male chicks in vitro and then basically kill them before they get to a point of consciousness and pain and all of the things that we want to avoid. And currently, France is trying to push the policy through with the rest of the EU to try and make modifications onto agricultural practices. It is only expected to add an extra euro cent per box of 6 eggs going forward.
Wasn't it pushed through for the entire EU to be by 2022? Yep. That had to be the policy.
Yep. So it's
by 2022.
From my understanding, that's been passed, I thought, but I could be wrong.
It sounds like it's still sort of ongoing. They've got a similar policy in place as well to stop the castration of live awake male piglets, which is a horrible process that actually Canada has put some policies in the US to try and stop. We used to go out into the field and you would literally just flip them over, make a small incision, drag the testicles out, and then just sort of stuff everything back in with an antiseptic spray. And thank God we're not allowed to do that anymore, or we're not supposed to.
I have some personal positive news.
Ooh.
I, thanks to a wonderful pair of co-hosts, Sam and Dave, am officially a baroness.
Woo! Good, it arrived.
Finally! Oh my God, I was wondering when that was going to come through.
Yes, it actually came in like 2 weeks ago, but I've been waiting for both of you to be back.
Okay.
So, listeners, wonderful, I am officially a baroness. I own a bit of property in Sealand.
In Sealand.
It is a proper noble title. So I will be absolutely using that on all of my letterhead. So
you are 100% officially a baroness.
She's part of the landed nobility.
Yes. Congrats.
Yeah. So when we got the doctor title, I was told use it on credit cards, but not on passports. But I reckon you can put baroness on a passport.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. Why not on a passport?
Because then you get in that nightmare scenario of an air stewardess coming down being like, hey, you're a doctor, right?
I am. Do you have any parasites you need help with?
Just walk up inspecting some guy like frothing in the seat, just like, doesn't look like a parasite infection to me. I'm sorry, I can't help you.
You'd better tell the captain we've got to land as soon as we can. This woman has to be gotten to a hospital.
A hospital? What is it?
It's a big building with patients, but that's not important right now.
So, Spirited Away is about a 10-year-old girl named Chihiro. Her and her family are moving away from their old neighborhood to a new neighborhood. She's very scared about it. You see her in the beginning of the movie being, honestly, kind of a baby.
Incredible baby.
Then do they take a wrong turn? I can't remember how they get derailed.
It's...
The father's looking for a shortcut?
They miss their turn, and he says, oh, it's probably a shortcut. This will be fine.
The which classic is father move. So
classic
yes,
dad behavior.
Making good time on the freeway gets me chuffed.
So he goes... careening down this cobblestone road
this
in the woods,
footpath.
Going like 70 miles per hour, endangering the lives of his family. And they stumble upon an abandoned amusement park. They go in exploring, thinking it's pretty cool. Chihiro's very tentative about it because she's scared of everything. And the family soon finds a sort of food stall where the parents begin quasi-stealing food. Saying they'll pay it back later, and eating it, and they turn into pigs. So the story focuses on Chihiro getting swept into this spirited world of, what are they called? Kami?
Is that
how spirits, we pronounce
Kami.
It? Kami?
Kami. Yeah. So Kami are Japanese spirits. So it is a bathhouse for these Japanese spirits, and she has to work for the owner of the bathhouse, this evil witch named Yubaba, to try and free herself and free her parents, all the while dealing with a creepy dude named No Face and a boy slash dragon called Haku.
Hakuna Matata. What a wonderful phrase.
Hakuna Matata. Ain't no passing craze.
So, what did we like about this movie? Who wants to go first?
Okay. I thought this movie was lovely. Yep. I think that my my friend from here, Ben, kind of summarized the Ghibli movies the best in saying that they give you this sense of nostalgia for something you've never had, which I very much got from this movie. This is actually the first time I've seen this movie. I know it's been out for 20 years, but I completely missed the boat on it for a very long time. This is only the second movie from Studio Ghibli that I've seen, which I will be touching on more next week. But it's lovely. I really enjoy the setting. The characters are all very weird. It's a very fully fleshed out world, even though you only see a little bit of it. And I really enjoy that.
I think for me, this is the fourth time I've seen this movie. Fourth time. And when I first saw this movie, I didn't like it. And everyone and their mother loves this movie. And it took me watching this a bunch to really appreciate it. And now I love it. I don't know why that was, but I think for me, it's such a fantastical world of seeing all these different spirits and like, just like the weird, crazy concept of they're in like a bathhouse and like getting their spa day.
With hundreds of employees.
It's very Alice in Wonderland to me. And I, in a good way, I think that whimsy is what makes this movie for me.
I love the soundtrack. I love the nice like long shots where it just comes back to like beautiful music flittering over like a field or a chunk of water associated with the spirit characters. And I always love the idea that a lot of these films go into where the villain at the end of it is actually far less villainous than we were led to believe. There's good, there's elements, there's a lot of gray that gets shaded in as the movie goes on, of these initially very black and white scary characters get way more dimension as the film rolls. Sam?
I really like No Face.
Yeah.
From, you know, all the marketing I'd seen beforehand, I thought No Face was going to be this creepy, horrifying villain, but it turned out to be a just a lonely a lonely individual.
Yeah.
Yeah. I liked how weird everything looked. And I enjoy when a character is dumped into the middle of a crazy world and they're just like, oh, okay, yep, this is how things are now.
Yeah.
And there's just no explanation. And Chihiro is just like, oh, yeah, okay, no, this all makes total sense. I'm not going to question the nature of reality or anything here. Yeah.
Yeah. You have to go to Kamaji. You have to get a job.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Don't worry about this world. Don't worry that your parents are pigs. Worry about gainful employment right now. Yeah. I'll carry on though, because into what we don't like. So this is very subjective. This is just personally. These movies really aren't for me. I couldn't really get behind this at all. I found myself kind of constantly looking at the time to see how much was left. I felt like it dragged a lot in places. Like when you get to the 50-minute mark and she's crying about the fact that, you know, her parents are pigs, I'm like, this must have taken like 20, 25 minutes. Yeah. And it's almost the entire first hour. It felt really disjointed as well.
And the ending can, yeah.
Like I felt like I was watching like 6 20-minute episodes of something at times. And last thing, and people are probably going to write in letters for this so we can delete it if it's too bad, but everybody has a certain style of animation that kind of creeps them out. For me, it's any time they adapt Dr. Seuss to a movie, and this. I don't know what it is, but...
My sister is the same way. She hates Dr. Seuss. She thinks it's super creepy.
The fucking noses, like, in Dr. Seuss, just every time there's a Dr. Seuss animated film, I'm like, no, I can't. But yeah, the animation style here as well, there's just something about it that I just...
I will say that I start running into some difficulties. My partner and I rewatched this last night, and the end with interactions with Mbaba's, like, sister, where she comes off and... Yeah, she comes off initially as this big villain who's like, by the way, if you scream, I'll tear your throat out. And then suddenly they go to our house and she's like, hi, just call me Granny. And the Granny thing irks me every time. I have a lot of trouble with that, where it's like, oh, and like there's a lot of hugging at the end. Still love this film. But the
relationships get formed like at that the end, in this movie. She just falls in love with Haku after knowing him for 3 hours.
It does close itself off fairly quickly. Still love, I cringed all the way through all the Granny scenes last night.
Dude, her house is legit though.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's a proper cabin.
Yeah, absolutely. For me, it's the screaming. It's an anime thing. I love anime, don't get me wrong. But I cannot stand, especially when they're children characters, which typically tend to be in anime, when they're like yelling for no reason. So she's constantly like, Haku! Ah! I'm like, stop screaming. Like, why are you yelling? So that's my gripe.
Mine's kind of in the same
way. What do you prefer, this constant yelling or the people just standing there going, Yeah.
But I think the screaming thing's the same for me. It's just, especially with this, with the voice actor who did young Lilo in Lilo and Stitch. But because we watched the English dub, because that's just how it automatically started on the DVD, unfortunately.
Oh, really? Okay.
But
I've seen it both ways, and they scream in both.
Oh, I'm sure they scream both ways. But I just mean, I'm just not a big fan of whenever there is just either an adult doing a kid voice or a kid just doing their normal kid voice, and there's a lot of shrillness, a lot of whininess, and I cannot stand that. And I feel like that, for me, was the only thing really taken away from my enjoyment of this movie.
Oh, also the big, fat, creepy baby.
Yeah, with his butt hanging out the entire time. Not great.
Oh, just awful.
That is actually another thing I like. Like when they get transformed into the two miniature versions, I'm like, they're like, perfect. I like them more than C-3PO and the other one.
Yep.
Yeah, the other one. R2-D2.
The other one.
the other one.
The more famous one.
I beg your pardon, but what do you mean, naked? My parts are showing. My goodness. Oh.
So for trivia, this movie won the Academy Award for Best Animated Feature at the 75th Academy Awards. But the cool part is it made it the first and only hand-drawn and non-English language animated film to win the award.
Cool.
So I thought that was pretty cool.
Super dope.
Yeah. And I know that Miyazaki wrote this script after he went over to his friend's house who has a 10-year-old daughter. So she would come over to their houses for summer or something. And so she kind of inspired him to write the script, which I thought was pretty sweet.
That is really cute.
On sort of trivia related stuff, Libby, you said you've watched this both with subs and with dubs. Mm-hmm. Is there a big difference?
I always find, to me, the emotion gets a little bit skewed when it's dubbed. Whenever I watch the sub versions, I feel like it's really how the director intended the scene to go. And then something gets a little bit, quite literally lost in translation whenever it's a dubbed. They'll just be things or reactions. I'm like, that wasn't what she did in their, quote, unquote, original.
Yeah.
And it just feels not as authentic, I guess.
Yeah, and Adam and I, we lived in Germany together. Germany has a massive dubbing industry. They have actors who are dedicated to certain English actors. People grow up with it, so they're much more used to it. And so I personally grew up with subtitles. I hate dubbed films, but I did watch a couple when I was over in Germany. And every now and then, I'll be like, hang on, that's not what... That, no, mm-hmm. no, 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 no. And often over here as well, I watch English films with Norwegian subtitles to work on my Norwegian, and I'll read the Norwegian subtitle and I'm just like, that, no, that's not what they said.
Yeah.
Very different. I understand that a lot of people don't go to the cinema to read mm-hmm. for the entire film, which, fair enough. Sure, if that's not part of the movie going experience for you. But yeah, I find the same thing, Libby, you lose something when there's another person speaking over it. Although I know for Studio Ghibli, they did try to make the English audio as close as possible to the character's mouth movements.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I did notice that. There wasn't a lot of missing, weird talking when there wasn't any sound coming out, which I really appreciated for this. And I think that the voice actors did a fantastic job. What often happens, a recent case of the most recent Zelda game, A Breath of the Wild, the English actors are super flat, super boring,
very monotone.
No emotion. Mm-hmm. Then you turn it on to the original Japanese audio with English subtitles, and it's incredible. It's so much better.
Cool. Okay. Dave, where do you stand on this as an uncultured swine who can't speak any other languages?
Yeah, so... my partner sometimes seems to have trouble actually listening to these types of movies. So what we've been doing lately is if we watch, I get her to watch one of these cartoons, I will end up putting on the English dub, but then I also end up turning on the English subtitles for the translation.
Okay.
So I get to watch both, which we did last night. They lined up pretty well. There are some gaps where characters speak, or there's different terms that are used. So example, the baby is afraid of blood, not of germs, which I was like, oh, actually, I think I agree with the baby's fear of the blood more at that age than I do of the germs. Blood on me.
I just like the scene now where she's holding up this bloody hand. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, I mean, I definitely do not mind some good subtitles. And I find that it enhances. I would actually prefer to go the subtitle route most of the time.
So, before we start looking at the science today, if you've got any thoughts or questions, you can get in touch with Adam and I on Twitter. I'm at Big Dr. Fishboy. Adam is at Harsic Adam. If you want to get in touch with the podcast, you can visit our website, cinematicaanimalia.com, or email us at cinematica.animalia@gmail.com. If you want to read Libby's work, you can visit shortstorysoup.substack.com and sign up for fortnightly emails with new stories. And if you want to hear about some of the more hardcore science that Adam, myself, and a huge team of international writers write about, you can check out ecologyforthemasses.com. So, like I mentioned earlier on, we're going to be focusing primarily on No Face today.
So, No Face is this black, possibly robed. It kind of looks like a robe. But
seems to be a robe.
Also could be his body. And he is wearing a traditional Japanese mask. I think they're, at least with the samurai warriors, they're called Minyoroi. I'm going to totally botch the pronunciation of that. And he has a very, very large mouth with flat teeth. And that's kind of all we really get of him. He's, how tall would you say he is?
About 5 feet or so.
Yeah.
At most. Maybe so 100.
In his original form, yeah, before he starts.
In original form. In his original form, he is bipedal, and he's got two arms that we see, but most of his body is cloaked, if you will.
I've just read now on the Ghibli wiki that he... Ghibli, fuck's sake.
Ghibli. I know about this. Ghibli. Ghibli.
Ghibli. On the Ghibli wiki, that his physical appearance is taken from a silkworm.
Ah.
That makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which is, yeah. For those who don't know what silkworms are, they're the kind of larval form of a silk moth, and they produce massive amounts of...
silk. Well, silk thread. Silk. That yeah. fabric that no one listening to this can afford, so...
Yeah. You never know that, Dave. We might have some people sitting up and sipping Chateau de Chasselet, listening to Cinematica Animalia.
We know Bezos listens every week.
Yeah, absolutely. Of course. Yeah. Never misses.
Wearing his dumb fucking cowboy hat.
Wearing his silk cowboy hat.
Don't alienate our listeners.
How about you help fucking fight climate change, you fucking...
If he wants to sponsor us, I'll say nice things about him, but until then...
So, Libby, you were explaining that he has two forms.
Well, he appears to have the ability to swallow creatures and use those physical and vocal attributes to mimic them.
Mm.
So he changes shape in the movie quite a bit. He swallows a frog early on and then kind of assumes some of those attributes.
Yeah. And classic kind of ambush predator tactics, right, Adam? Like, he lures them in with something, in this case, fool's gold or fake gold. I don't know what you'd call it.
Pyrite.
And
then, bang! The term for that kind of rock, fool's gold, is pyrite. But yeah, he has what appears to be gold, and the frog is being very greedy.
He's an alchemist.
Coming out of, coming out late to get the leftover gold from the river monster, the river spirit that came in earlier, speaking of climate change earlier, full of trash.
Yeah.
And frog trying to be greedy. No face is like, hey, come over here. Look, more gold. The frog's like, ooh, gold. And then chomp, gets swallowed. And then no face immediately has the more frog-like appearance with the backwards bent or the big frog legs. And he's perching on top of the divider to make the manager bring him more food.
Yeah. Do we think that could just be because he's gotten so much larger, like he's having to lean forward and use all four limbs as opposed to walking upright?
He's not that much larger at that point. He's a bit bigger as soon as he swallows the frog.
Mm.
But it's more of just an immediate physical transformation than the growth.
Okay. Okay. But ambush predators are super cool. Like, we have got some classic... The most classic example I can think of someone that lures shit in is the one, you know, like an anglerfishes down in the deep. Those sexy, sexy ladies.
Fish-eating snails, we've talked about before. One of my favorite species, dangling sort of that worm-like protrusion until a fish gets close, harpoon it, then suck that bad boy in and eat it live.
Yeah.
Are there examples of larger ambush predators?
Alligator, snapping turtle.
What do they do?
And I mean...
Sam, when he's under his bridge.
Sam under his bridge. Alligator, snapping turtle, for those of you who aren't from North America, if you haven't seen these, are massive, massive turtles that... they wait in the water. They have a huge and very strong beak. They open their mouth. They have a tongue that looks like a worm. They kind of just wriggle it around a little bit. And a fish is like, oh my God, a worm. And they swim right into the mouth and they get chomped.
Oh, when No Face manages to like grab these things, he's pulling them in. And yeah, he does seem to be getting bigger as this goes on. Now, the hope from a physiology perspective here is that he's using some of the traits that we see present within our snake species. That are able to take in and obviously expand in size as they're able to pull these creatures into them. Now, the way that snakes are capable of doing this is really fucking cool. So, unlike humans, which have sort of a fused jaw, the snake's upper jaw is actually just attached by a series of muscles and ligaments that basically connect all of them. So snakes are able to move their two jaws completely independently of each other. There isn't like a direct bone connection. So that's what gives them that mechanism to expand their mouth basically over whatever they're trying to eat. And then the other really cool feature is, and I don't know if you guys have ever wondered about this, I definitely have. when snakes need to breathe, they still need to be able to breathe with their mouth full. Like when you see them like eating for those long periods of time. So they're actually able to extend the tube that they breathe through, their modified trachea, out around their prey so that they can continue to breathe while they're taking in these super large meals. They have changed. Super important. Now, to eat and try to take these things in, they have a whole bunch of different setups that have been investigated that allow them. So one, the snakes, when they open their jaw wide, they actually seem to walk their lower jaw kind of over top of the animal. And then they've got they drench the prey actually in their saliva to basically create a slip and slide to help move that bad boy in. The digester's tract runs the entire like course of their body. And they, in order to circulate air, snakes don't actually have a diaphragm like you or I do. So they circulate the air in and out of their lungs by narrowing their rib cage to basically push air in and out and then widening it again to create a vacuum. They have these breathing cycles called apnea. So their breathing actually stops occasionally and it can last a couple of seconds where they basically process oxygen and then repeat the process to breathe again. All of them have an elongated right lung, and some of them actually have a smaller left lung to breathe better through, or a third lung that's present along the trachea. Now,
I didn't know that.
Yeah. So No Face could definitely be doing these types of things. He doesn't seem to be holding it for very long in his mouth when he's like pulling those things in, but he is going to have to.
I don't think we ever see him struggle with anything. It's instantaneous. And yeah. For the three sentient creatures he eats, it's like instantaneous.
Right. Now, if No Face was real, he would likely have to be taking a minute to fit these things in. Now, once they pass through his mouth, they then run into the really fucking cool section of the snake digestion, which is after the snake sort of pulls their prey in, they have to begin what's called the transport cycle. So to do this, they do that initial walk that we were talking about where like they open up their jaw and they actually have a ratchet mechanism that's present in their mouth that basically like ratchets and starts to pull the prey in. Two, they are able to compress their own vertebral column, kind of like a accordion, to kind of like suck it in as they go. So they kind of like compress themselves around it basically as they go along. And they actually have a whole series of muscles that are present inside that are able to force the prey's vertebral column to bend into waves and also compress. So they can actually compress the package of food that they're eating as they're eating it, which allows them to
share the word for that muscular process, which is one of my favorite words in biology.
Peristalsis.
Yes.
Yeah.
Such a cool word.
It's so cool. So our No Face totally could be doing this. Now, there's only one problem which we have to talk about with No Face. Is one, he's going to have a very interesting skeleton. Snakes are made up of this tiny series of bones. If you ever look at them, their bone structure compared to us is a whole network that allows them to expand out and collapse down. So No Face is probably going to have a really cool fucking skeleton. But two, most animals when eaten alive don't love to be eaten alive, which is why snakes have mechanisms like crushing their prey down, or the one that I think No Face is most likely going to use, he's probably going to have some form of paralytic.
I just wanted to say, surely he should have some digestive juices as well. Like, those things come out, like, shouldn't they be, like, screaming in pain?
Well, the people do. The people don't, but the food comes out as this half-digested slop.
Right. So yeah. He's currently not got all the way through the process, but I was rewatching it last night. When the frog first comes out, it lays in the water for a couple of seconds before it blinks its eyes and gets up and starts moving. Mm-hmm. I wonder whether or not the saliva that's excreted has some type of paralytic engaged, because you don't see him biting anything. I'm wondering if he just slobbers over you. There's a quick transport mechanism through the skin. It can't be as fast as it is in the movie, but it potentially could still work. And it's getting pulled into these organisms and it's fairly short acting. But yeah, it's super fucking cool for him to like pull this material in and start expanding like a giant snake.
Yeah, and speaking of giant snakes, like the other trait that I thought was really cool here is indeterminate growth, which I don't think we've touched on too much before. Yeah, so this thing, No Face, he does seem to be constantly growing. There are a couple of comments that are made of it just keeps getting bigger. Now, obviously, with any species, this wouldn't happen on a short-term basis. Like, you can't just, you know, grow and just... Well, for vertebrates anyway, like you can't just constantly expand with how much you're eating, because I mean, why would you stop? Being big is, you know, great.
I don't know. I did grow 4 inches in a summer, Sam.
Fair enough, yeah. No, I mean, oh, all that alcohol, you know, drinking with Cammy's parents, it does tend to increase the size of certain areas. But this, there is, you know, plenty of records of indeterminate growth. Perhaps the most famous example that people might know of is anacondas. So there's a lot of, you know, stuff thrown out. Anacondas will just keep growing until they die. There's a reason a lot of species don't do this, because it sounds really good, right? Like, you get bigger, you're able to fend off more competitors, you're able to catch prey easier, that sort of thing. But there are big trade-offs. So there's genuinely a trade-off between size and reproduction. If you put a lot of energy into reproducing,
I love reproducing.
That's energy you can't put into growth later on. But there's also a converse trade-off because, I mean, generally, the larger you are, the more fertile or fecund is the term that we generally use, you are. But if you put effort into reproducing early on, you limit your ability to grow larger and become more fecund. So there are species that will... I mean, that's why you have often species won't reproduce until they get to a certain age because they need to grow big enough to, you know, successfully reproduce and not hurt their chances of growing large enough later in life.
Humans, elephants, so on and so forth.
Yeah.
It's called a type 1 reproduction curve.
Hmm. Yeah. You don't often... It does happen, and it happens across a lot of different different types of animals and plants. But often species will allocate more resources to reproducing because, I mean, that's what pushes your genes forward, reproducing, as opposed to growing indeterminately.
Cool.
Are goldfish indeterminate growth?
They are not.
Okay. I think that's like a common myth that
you put them in a bigger tank.
The size of their bowl. Yeah.
Goldfish grow to about 1 foot or 30 centimeters. Mm. They're big fish. And people saying that they just stop growing when the tank is too small, they'd stop because they die. Like, you can't just put them in a little 4-liter or 1-gallon tank and be like, oh, it's good. No. These fish are big. They need a really big aquarium.
Yeah, they just found one. I don't know what state it was, but it was...
Yeah, I saw that.
Massive. Yeah.
When they're becoming a really problematic invasive species in lots of different parts of the world. Yeah, because they get out and all of a sudden they have a lot more space. They can reproduce. A lot of populations are still highly inbred, but they're just really voracious predators when they get out there. So please don't flush your goldfish down the toilet.
Blonker, you think I don't know the toilet when I see one? You were gonna flush me down the loo.
No.
Our No-Face also has a really interesting ability in this. So on top of his ambush predator, he seems to be able to take on some traits very similar to whatever he's eating and kind of alter his behavior, his voice pattern, and his physical kind of position throughout the film. Now, there are a couple of species that do this in nature. The one that Adam, Sam, and I suspect Libby and I universally love being the mimic octopus. Now, I was actually, we've talked briefly about the mimic octopus before, but just as a brief overview, they're a species that is capable of changing their form to basically mimic other animals in order to try and either scare off prey or scare off predators, lure in prey, or, you know, avoid conflicts with other organisms in order to get from one space to another. And I was actually looking through yesterday the wide variety of creatures they're able to mimic. So they can mimic a lionfish in order to, like, sticking out their arms to try and look poisonous to keep things away, or mimicking
very
sea snake.
Venomous fish.
Mm-hmm. They have been observed to mimic jellyfish, basically trailing their limbs behind themselves again, as well as mimicking something called a zebra sole. And basically, like, almost looking like it has this sort of other arrangement. They seem to be able to mimic flatfish, and it seems to be a preferred guise. There's apparently still a big discussion around ecologists as to why the flatfish tends to be the one that it seems to position itself in most often. But then the one that I was looking at yesterday that I hadn't realized was that it is able to mimic a crab and basically lure in other crabs that think that it's going to mate. And then when they get close, it eats it, which feels like the worst fucking catfish that's out there. All right. It's a cannibal system where, like, you show up and you're like, I heard I was going to get laid. And they're like, no.
about that.
Right. You're not actually going to get laid. You're going to get eaten.
Right. There was some discussion of eating. I'm going to be eating you.
There will be breakfast in bed.
Now,
this is pretty good. Sam just sent through a XKCD comic of the Southeast Asian sea life. And it's images of many different fish, an anchor, what looks like a submarine, a big octopus, a school of fish, a human scuba diver. But they're all labeled as the mimic octopus.
Except for the actual octopus, which is labeled as two mimic octopus.
Two mimic octopus.
I didn't even notice. That's fantastic.
So the two questions that I had for you guys from sort of like an ecology perspective are, one, are there any ambush predators that use mimicry to like accomplish this? Aside from this whole lure your mate in and be like, yeah, we're totally going to fuck. Just get a little closer. And the use of intelligence, because that's been the thing that's been brought up on a pretty regular basis for the mimic octopus, is they're able to obviously observe other animals and change their shape accordingly. I don't think that we have any concerns here saying that No Face is very clever.
Oh, yeah.
Well, No Face seems to vacillate between being pretty simple to very intelligent and going back to very simple, depending on what he's eating.
I just think he's a very intelligent predator, but doesn't have good social skills. In regards to your question, Dave, there's mixes of the two, right? So there's lots of predators who are, no, I wouldn't say predators, plants who mimic a female of the species so that the male will come along and pollinate them. And there's, again, lots of plants who mimic the smell of food. So carnivorous plants who will mimic the smell of certain pollens or sugars or dead flesh, in the case of Rafflesia, to draw in insects to eat. But the combination of those two, mimicking a female or a male of the species to eat the other biological sex, I can't think of one.
One of the dragonfly species in this area is the eastern pond hawk. It is one of the more voracious odonates. Odonates tend to eat each other like crazy. And they are sexually dimorphic. So the males are this blue color and the females have this striped green and black coloration. And juvenile non-sexually reproductive males will actually have female coloration to avoid being eaten by other males until they are then sexually mature, at which point all of their chitin switches from that green-black arrangement to the powder blue of the adult male, which is really weird because it happens after their exoskeleton is already hardened. So that's a really weird molecular mechanism going on there. But that's more an avoiding predation thing than achieving predation.
Yeah.
I'm googling mimicking female to eat male animal. I am just checking that my safe search is on.
It's put minus four.
Rule 34.
Choosing mates wisely is all the more important when they try to eat you. Ah, it's praying mantises again.
Or spiders.
I mean, I couldn't think of a good system. I can totally see why it would be important to create a lure, creating that gold that draws the creatures in so that it can eat them or get food. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I never had a good mechanism that I could think about watching that would be important to mimic those animals, because they don't seem to care. You could look bipedal, you could look any shape that you wanted, and they're still, as long as you can speak, probably going to end up giving you food and getting close enough as long as you have gold.
I think that that little lure aspect works. I think that what might actually be going on is that he is a more, can switch between being a quadruped or a biped, and those frog-looking legs are his real legs, because it makes it makes more sense, I think, to be adapted to the environment that your prey is in. So if he, let's just say that the frog that he eats first is his normal prey, like in a swamp, and he just also has these kind of frog-looking legs to be able to quickly move either by hopping on land or swimming through the water. So I think that's just more of his natural formation that we then see more of as he gets bigger.
Do you think that he is intentionally trying to eat the frog to gain access to the voice? Because No Face himself does not speak.
I think it's just more serendipitous by anything as far as that goes.
You can't eat anything and get its voice.
Serendipitous? You too good to say lucky? Motherfucker.
Jeez. I'm a doctor now. I have to say big words.
You really have gone all hoity-toity, married to a bloody baroness, huh?
Exactly.
Ivory Tower scientist over here.
Yeah.
So can we safely say that No Face himself is a mimic octopus?
He probably is. There's no evidence against it, so I think we have to, by default, say he's a mimic octopus.
Yeah, a very large one. Well, jeez. Dave, what would happen to like a normal animal, do you think, if it just started vomiting up everything?
Bad. I mean,
how long would it take for its like throat to corrode?
Well, it depends. I mean, there are some animals that regurgitate, right? We've got lots of
Bloody Adam when he's drinking out on Saturday night, all the bloody time can't hold his liquor.
When there's an open bar at a wedding for the first half of the wedding and they have wine and you don't realize how much wine you've been drinking and you want to dance, you go in the bathroom and you throw up a little bit and then you can dance some more.
You just no face it.
Cheeky spew.
There are lots of fermenting species like cows that we regularly reference that are capable of bringing material up just to chew it more and put it back down. And there are some species that are capable of regularly regurgitating if they're in a situation where they've swallowed poisonous poisonous or toxic material. It's what makes horses an absolute pain in the ass because they're not capable of vomiting or regurgitating. Something that I've told to Sam before, and it's fucking nightmarish, and I have no idea why anybody would allow that mechanism to exist, but more proof that there is no God.
I mean, I think it works really well for No Face too, because he's doing it. I mean, it's shown because he's eating this medicine that is purging him of all this nonsense in him, but he's also trying to chase down Chihiro. And if an organism like a snake that eats a enormous amount of food all at once and needs to escape, it will try to regurgitate it so it's in a bit quicker. Which we see in that documentary Anaconda, where the anaconda vomits up John Voight, who is still kind of alive.
So this is the equivalent of Adam still wanting to try and dance while vomiting. Basically running along the entire time and still trying to get on the dance floor.
Or a table.
Uh-huh.
Or a bar. Very hardcore sparkle party. German sparkle party.
The last sort of point that I wanted to sneak in, just for completely selfish reasons, that Kamaji is my absolutely favorite character in this entire show, and his little soot balls that he gets to move around are the only way that I was able to get my partner to watch this movie, because she was like, all right, they're really cute and they get little star things as their like food to like wander around and shaking them sprinkles over their heads. So, Libby, do you want to describe Kamaji?
He has... How many arms does he have?
Six arms.
Six arms.
Yeah. He looks like Sonic the Hedgehog's Eggman.
Dr. Robotnik. The love child of Dr. Robotnik and a spider.
And a spider. Yes, I could see that. But he's got that big, like, bristly mustache. He wears goggles. He has... the arms appear to have, like, no limit to their stretch or reach. So... he's very Gumby-like in that fashion.
They gain joints as needed.
Mm-hmm. Kamaji is the boiler man and responsible for mixing all those herbs that make up the boiler water. Now, the part of my brain that kicked in when I was watching this last night was really, really excited by his motor coordination. So the brain's motor system is primarily controlled in the frontal lobes. It starts in what are called the premotor areas. This is what we use for planning, coordinating complex movement. But then it ends in what's called your primary motor cortex. This is the final output, basically, before the signal is sent down your spinal cord and then causes specific movements. Now, the primary motor cortex is really cool. It's split into a whole bunch of different areas, with the left side of the brain controlling movement on the right side and vice versa. And different areas of the primary motor cortex are differently sized in order to try and better coordinate different areas of movement. And really fine movement, so the action of individually moving all of your fingers coordinates to actually a much more complex activity than the action of running. And so as a result, the areas of fine movement in the brain make up a bigger area. The areas that are associated with your hands are huge. And the areas that are associated with like legs or torso or things like that, the areas of the brain to coordinate them are much smaller because there's not really that much fine movement. What we refer to this body map is called a homunculus. And basically looking at it, and there's a bunch of great diagrams if you want to look online that show kind of how we break up the human brain. And you end up with these like giant parts of the brain that reference huge hands. Now, what I kept thinking while I was watching this movie is I would give an arm and a leg to try and get a either MRI of Kamaji and try to see the areas of his brain, because it's going to be really developed. His fine motor skills on all of his limbs are really good. He's reaching out and doing these really complex movements, or in a much more dark way, and I apologize. A post-mortem on his brain tissue would be absolutely fascinating.
For listeners, Dave did not say post-mortem when he first... He just said straight up, I want to dissect his brain.
I want to pick apart his brain. and get at that sweet, sweet big homunculus brain.
And he said, on a somewhat more morbid note for our listeners, but he had a massive smile on his face while he was saying it.
He did.
I still have a massive smile on my face.
Dave, like, you don't necessarily have... I mean, we've talked about Neanderthals before, but a larger head doesn't necessarily mean, like, improved, like, neural function, right? Like, they think that a lot of birds have much denser brains.
Yeah. You know? And so, it's not necessarily the density that's important here, because there is a limitation to how dense the neural tissue becomes. It's the pathways that have to be available for individual movement. So, as any of us, probably Libby is an exception. Well, I don't know. She could be a terrible dancer. I'm a terrible dancer. And trying to coordinate myself while dancing on...
I'm a terrible dancer as well. Adam is not.
It is a lot easier to do small motions associated with your hands in terms of individually moving your fingers, just matters of inches or centimeters, than it seems to be for me to like move my hips on the dance floor or try to move a leg in a way that doesn't look like Gumby caught in the wind. And I oftentimes simply attribute that to the fact that I probably have a malformed brain.
I mean, so you don't have that part of the brain that really developed where you can move your right butt cheek clockwise and your left butt cheek counterclockwise at the same time?
Now, suddenly I'm very interested in an MRI or postmortem of Adam's brain if I could just find the butt cheek center if you're capable of actually doing this.
I could have whooped his ass, Daddy, but this gravel, I slipped on it and...
Yeah, well, maybe you need to do a few more butt flexes.
The big thing that I kept thinking about while watching this is... No Face isn't just going to be able to stuff these things into his system and then likely immediately pull them in and go back to what he's doing. Does the storyline change if No Face has to slowly take in one of these waiters over the course of, like, I don't know, 15, 20 minutes? And we'll eventually get to a point that he's full and he'll probably go sleep in the back of the bathhouse for a while.
Well, I mean, I think the first, the frog that he eats... the first time around absolutely works because it's like during the night, well, day technically for them because it's flip-flopped, but yeah, it's like during the night and he's like by himself in the bathtub house portion thing, so he has plenty of time to digest that frog and alter his shape and take a nap if he wishes, but yeah, I don't think that he would be able to just willy-nilly start scarfing down
employees
and lines of food, cooked food.
Could we make this work as a live adaptation with a group of teenagers caught in an abandoned bathhouse while they're simultaneously getting hunted by the No Face creature?
I would love to see that movie.
Pretty fun.
I think you could still make it, you know, because Spirited Away at its core, the themes are a coming of age movie. So it's all about Chihiro growing up into a quote unquote young woman, abandoning childhood fears. So I think you could still make it very poetic about these teenagers coming into this horrifying bathhouse with No Face hunting them, and they realize that they're much stronger than they thought they were.
I'm just trying to imagine Haku's modification being one of those douchebags that wears a t-shirt with a dragon on it all the time and it's like, this is fucking badass.
He wears like Ed Hardy. Yeah, I am the river spirit man.
So Haku.
See, the muscle shirt came today. Muscle's coming tomorrow.
You get a tracking number?
Boy, I hope you got a tracking number.
That package is going to be smaller than one you're currently sporting.
Tall order, Derry.
You ever had a cup of fart?
You can cup a fuck off.
Do we feel bad for No Face?
As he is in the movie? Yeah. As a creature? No. He's just a predator trying to eat.
Yeah.
I feel bad for Kimaji.
Yeah, I feel really bad for Kimaji. He's
toiling away in the basement.
With?
And he just gives up his tickets.
Sit friends.
He saved up his tickets for 40 years and he just gives them up to this little girl he just met. He's such a sweetie.
Yeah. And she...
How long has he been there for?
It seems like they're all immortal, so who knows?
Yeah.
Yeah. I didn't feel bad for No Face purely because he got a nice little redemption arc and a nice little job with Zeniba at the end. Yeah. Yeah. And that was nice. I like that. You know, I like the fact that I enjoyed No Face's story in this a lot more than most of the other characters.
Sam, you asked how long Kimaji has been there for. When he started, he only had two arms.
And like the tiniest mustache that you've ever seen, and a full head of hair.
He was going through puberty.
I still worry that No Face is way more evil than we think he is, because when he's big, he's chasing her around the bathhouse trying to eat her. And the minute that he gets forced into vomiting the others and he goes back to being small, he's like, I'm innocent now. Nobody fight or hurt me. Nah, I still think he's secretly a
very
dick.
Very manipulative, yeah. Would we recommend this movie?
Yes. 100%.
Yeah, 100%.
If you like Alice in Wonderland or Mary Poppins or those movies that transport you into a world that makes, like Sam said earlier, that makes absolutely no sense, then yeah, I think you should watch this. Yeah. If you're not a fan of that style, then it's probably not going to be for you.
I wouldn't recommend this movie, but I would recommend maybe just watching it to get a taste of what Studio Ghibli's like, because it is very interesting. Mm-hmm. Like, it was an interesting experience. And I would also definitely recommend this over any adaptation of Alice in Wonderland.
Yes.
100%. So, next week we'll be touching on Sam's favorite movie, Printer's Monocle, also known as Princess Mononoke.
Nice.
And remember,
it's autocorrect. I'm not being disrespectful to Japanese culture.
It's because Sam has become super Norwegian and he's very afraid of other cultures now. It is, mm-hmm. Yeah, Princess Mononoke next
especially
week.
Especially the Swedes.
Especially the Swedes, those animals. So remember, the monsters aren't real, but the science is.
Bye, guys.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Walt Disney Studios presents a Studio Ghibli film. Experience a magical movie phenomenon embraced by all the world.
Let's go!
This fall, prepare to be spirited away.